Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Ruler of Kings by Ron C. Nieto, narrated by Dan Kelly. Chapter 1. Conscription and Command. When going to war, the size of the army at one's back mattered, but the crux of it, the tipping point, had little to do with numbers. Oren would have exchanged his 3,000 for half as many and done it gladly, if that meant his men didn't have a vested interest in his death. He couldn't change the troops under his command, though. For that matter, he couldn't refuse to command them either. He might have killed the Myrdoni High King while following Myrdoni law to the letter, but he depended on the goodwill of the city kings to make it out of Myrdan alive. If they forced him to have an accident, little would stand in their way. If they obeyed their own principles, with honour and the law coming above everything else, then Oren would return home, and he would bring with him the hope of peace with Myrdan, along with a diminished Svei threat. He just had to get the Myrdoni army to obey him, keep them from stabbing his back, and win the civil war his actions had precipitated without alienating the populace from his cause.
"I don't understand."
The hatred dripping from the officer he addressed licked at his skin, thick and heavy, impossible to miss.
"Of course you don't."
Oren slipped into Westmerian before switching to Myrdoni, his accent rounding the words just a touch too much to pass as a native to the trained ear. "You realize your refusal to follow the orders of your parliament at this time is the highest form of treason." The man's chest swelled, his eyes widening, his color rising. Anger swept over the previous disdain, igniting the man's temper, and Oren fought back the smirk, pulling at the corner of his lips. Ah, so the staunch patriot understood the foreigner's attempt at butchering his native tongue when honour stood on the line. Good to know. The Myrdoni officer's colour darkened as he realised Oren had caught him out. Eyes sliding from Oren, he let his gaze rest in the middle distance. The look of soldiers everywhere when required to stand at ease for long periods of uninteresting time. A sad state of affairs when the bedamned fool was among the best of the lot. Many other officers had outright ignored Oren's summons, even when delivered through official channels. The full authority of Parliament backing the call hadn't commanded obedience. But who was the bedamned fool, really? The officer who refused to bend for the man behind the greatest defeat his kingdom had experienced in over 100 years, or the man who knew the Myrdoni saw him as an enemy and still agreed to lead an army of them into battle? Oren knew the answer, so he avoided dwelling on the question.
"Zosimos of Tiganian leaves Deziniki as we speak," he said, still speaking near perfect Myrdoni.
"If he reaches his capital, he'll find reinforcements. It'll be a harder battle, and we can't afford to let him escape. Your laws and customs cannot afford his going unpunished." How the laws of a nation established it must grind to a halt if someone spilled blood during what amounted to a glorified council meeting, holding any decision-making until after the perpetrator faced punishment for his most heinous crime, baffled Oren. The ruling was inefficient at best, and at worst, it could delay matters until the choices that needed making didn't matter any more.
"That is a concern for us true Myrdoni,"
the officer finally answered, even if he still refused to look at Oren.
"We have no need of an enemy to guide us, less so when he's an untrustworthy cheat."
Fair enough. Oren had come close to breaking the spirit of the Myrdoni sacred rules, if not their actual words. The idea of defending against the claim left a bitter, ashen taste on his tongue. True, he had wrestled and had raced the horses as permitted. Not as expected, though. Not as deemed heroic. His actions stemmed from desperation, not honour. Still, every single one of your city kings sat by as I challenged your high king. Oren's voice sounded flat. Calm. How he made it sound like that after everything, he didn't know. Either they couldn't see the real threat of a Svei invasion couched as an offer of friendship, or they refused to risk themselves for the good of your people. I should think the situation called for a little guidance either way. Slowly, carefully, mindful of an attack, but pretending he didn't expect a knife between his ribs, Oren turned his back on the officer in time to give him the privacy to fume.
I'm not an enemy. The jibe was almost an afterthought, delivered once the Myrdoni brought himself under control. I'm your general. That was petty, and Oren knew it. He had to be above petty. As a man, as a king, and now as the appointed general of a kingdom who wished his entire bloodline dead and gone, he shouldn't indulge in such nonsense. But when the city kings of Myrdan had played him, when they had promised him a treaty and now they withheld even the hope of a negotiation until he went through their motions and jumped through their hoops, couldn't he allow himself pettiness? Oren sighed. No, he couldn't. Rather, he shouldn't. And that was near enough to make no difference. Go prepare your men, he called over his shoulder. Your parliament will give your orders, and when the time comes, you won't want to explain to them why Tiganian escaped. He moved without waiting for the man's answer. Why bother? It'd be another challenge, or worse. Likely worse. Where are we going? Clem asked at his elbow when they left the small plaza City King Spyro of Deziniki had given them to use as their centre of command. To find the Parliament, or the Assembly, whatever they wish to call themselves while waiting for their High King. If they want me to lead their armies, then they will give me control of their armies. They did, Clem pointed out. They sent out heralds to read the proclaim. You cannot make people listen when they refuse to do so. There was a moment of silence. And Oren's mind shot back to Berviel, to the mounting guard, to those few first Senites when he was the new Lord Captain, and not a single guardsman, not even Clem, held an ounce of respect for him. The irony, the absolute irony that the very thing that had gained him the hearts and loyalty of the mounting guard had also gained him the undying hatred of the Myrdoni. Not that it was a hard thing to earn, that hatred. It had dogged his people, and his family in particular, for generations. Oren had never expected to fare better than his forefathers in his diplomatic relationship with Myrdan. Then he had won the Battle of the Red Pass. His strategy and his men had massacred 500 Myrdoni cavalrymen, and all the hatred the country felt for his family as an abstract concept had turned personal. Oren blinked away the memory of those days, allowing himself a small smile at how events had played out. The very act that had gained him such hatred was also the reason the Myrdoni city kings had set him up as a general, wasn't it? Beyond the perk of painting a target on his back and throwing him to the walls, they knew what he could do on the battlefield. They hated Red Oren, and so they sought to unleash him on their enemies. Well, Red Oren would command their armies then. If they thought his actions in the Battle of the Red Pass were enough to earn him the moniker of King of Fire and Blood. A grim smile with no right to be called so, just a tightening of the lips that slanted his mouth with no mirth and too much determination. Oren didn't believe in prophecies. He stood master of his own fate, and so, because he willed it, because he saw no better option, he would seize the reins of that fate and give both Myrdan and Svetla the King of Fire and Blood they feared, and a reason to fear him besides. Chapter 2. The War Behind the Battle. As I recall, I requested a report of my available forces, Oren said by way of greeting when he found what could pass for the Assembly. A small gathering of city kings who stayed to discuss events around flagrant mugs of spiced wine. Instead of retiring to the residence of the local city king, they had found a terraced drinking house inside the walled citadel, a sort of tavern for nobility, with an outdoor patio that was well protected against the cold. The cold. Its teeth didn't bite so deep, and part of the reason was Deziniki's location that allowed for milder winters. Oren shook off the other part, the voice that whispered in his ear that spring was coming, and with it, the march on Westmere if he didn't defeat the traitorous Tiganian and his Svey allies first.
"We provided such report most graciously," one of the city kings said, a man dried up by age, with thinning white hair and crooked teeth, who still saw too much.
Oren blinked, pushed memories of Westmere and worries for his kingdom to the side. He believed this was the only way to serve his people. He would commit to his path. He owed them no less than his best attempt. "You have provided a list of your forces," he said, meeting the man's gaze until the mirth sluiced off those rheumy eyes. I'm glad to know the number of retainers each of you travels with, but I need to know how many soldiers are available to me. He knew the answer, of course. All the soldiers were his to command, and not a one was willing to follow his orders. That needed to change, and that was the reason he needed to have this conversation and set these boundaries.
"Wait, all of them,"
the man said, a stiff tone now replacing his jesting. Forcing the issue, wanting Oren to acknowledge he couldn't control the men the assembly had put under his command. Wrong move. That wasn't how the story would go. Oren didn't quite know who the man was and couldn't bring himself to care, but by virtue of speaking up, he made himself the enemy. No, not the enemy. They were allies after all, out of convenience, if nothing else. The opposition. The obstacle, then. "You appointed me a general, not a training master," Oren said, focusing on that one man, letting him witness the full bearing of his anger and determination. "I have no time to break and train useless men. Give me a report on my available battle-ready forces." That got under the man's skin. Myrdoni had pride, and when it came to battle, they had it in spades.
"Only the very best of our warriors receive the honor of serving their city kings as their traveling guard."
The old man set his cup on the low table with enough force to slosh the wine and splatter burgundy drops all over the linen tablecloth. "In Westmere, a man foolish enough to ignore a direct edict from his king doesn't deserve to be called a warrior, but I have no time to teach neither you nor your troops such nuanced differences. I'll ask again. Give me a report concerning the actual troops I can field."
"What kind of general are you if you can't make them obey?"
the man countered, ignoring the jab at nationalities and going straight for Oren's pride. Oren smiled. Pride. One more sacrifice to duty, one he had made a long time before. "I told you, one who doesn't have time to waste. I require my men to understand the basics of combat at the very least. The chain of command is one of those basic points." He produced the battered piece of parchment where the assembly had jotted numbers, units, and specialties. He let it fall on the table, one of its corners soaking up the red from the old king's spill. "Line drills is another. Basic marching order would be helpful, but it will be your own land suffering if they can't manage it. I will ask once more. What forces do I have right now?"
"Can't you tell?"
another city king said, younger but still well past his prime. More heavy set, though it was hard to tell how much of his bulk was muscle and how much had become fat. Oren nodded at the parchment. "I've summoned the commanding officer from each unit. 7 have shown up. 2 pretended not to understand my accent, another one said he would not follow my orders, and the rest held their silence. So yes, I can tell I have no fit soldiers. As a general without an army to field, I can say my duties are done and over with. It should shame you, I must say this, but your people deserve better, and so I'm here, trying to get this bedamned assembly to care enough about results to give me the tools I need to deliver them." Because those results meant lives spared, land unscorched, and traitors captured. They meant peace, even if bought at a steep price. If Oren could hit hard enough at the cult, no, not the cult, at the Svei who sought to use it, then he could keep them from marching on Westmere. Each battle fought in Myrdan would be a battle his people avoided. So fine, he was selfish, but he also understood war, and he did not wish it on Myrdan. Not on the innocents, the farmers, the traders, the children, and the elderly. Not on all those who would lose their lives and future if Tiganian remained free to sate his thirst for blood and vengeance. Oren took a step back, as if that could give him some distance from the facts. He closed his eyes, ran his hand through his hair. It was growing too long again, long enough to grasp and knot, and he really needed to get it cut. Curse it all. "You voted me a general," he said. "Tired, so very tired all of a sudden. Let me be the one. Or let me go home," he didn't say. It sat on the tip of his tongue, the yearning, but he swallowed it and opened his eyes with nothing but challenge in them. "If there's truth to your desire to win this war, then give me the men I need to deliver victory."
"How many?"
a man spoke up, and the rest quietened. Oren knew the voice. Cosmas Legeanos, a man overlooked by diplomacy everywhere, yet a man who held more power than any other city king in attendance. For a while, Oren had called him 13, and had thought they might be friends. Shaking that idea, Oren turned his focus to the question, twisting it this way and that in his mind. How many men did Oren need? It depended on how good they were. He'd seen about 1,000 Svei camped outside Tiganian, and while not all of them were warriors, he would bet all of them would put up a fight. Tiganian himself must have attended the Lumina Festival with an armed entourage of 200, or near enough to make no difference. Once he reached his city, he would raise twice as many fighters. Beyond the trained fighters and the recruits, there were always the fanatics, the people who would battle regardless of how ready they were because they felt too threatened to stay put. 2,000 enemies then, give or take. 1,200, Oren said. Less if we can keep Tiganian from retreating behind his walls and organizing a full-on response. Cosmas smiled, as if he had run the same numbers Oren had in his head.
You ask to be put in disadvantage.
I ask for what I believe I might get, Oren shook his head. And in truth, I don't believe you can command 1,200 of your men to follow my orders from what I've seen. But if you can, and if we can take action now, I can give you Tiganian.
Such certitude, the first city king said under his breath.
Cosmas ignored him and nodded.
I can give you 300, and they will follow you as they follow me.
Oren's eyes darted to the parchment, then away. The initial listing did not include any contingent from the steppes. He didn't need to check it to know the truth of it. Why now? Why not at first?
Bah, you'll have my men as well.
Akakios of Sitaria spoke up, both ally and greatest manipulator of them all.
Since the officer gave you trouble, replace him with Kiros. He'll be happy to learn how Westmerians understand war.
Kiros, the Sitari champion, a public figure in his own right. Oren liked the man well enough, although he wasn't certain whether he held any bitterness over the wrestling match Oren had not quite won, not quite lost. Still, he was a name and a face, someone the soldiers would know, and having him would make the Sitari group fall in line. Unless they took exception to their officer's relief and blamed Kiros. Better not to borrow trouble, though. After all, irresponsible as it was to ignore a direct edict, actively rebuking orders from the city king delivered through his favourite champion was another matter altogether. After that, one by one, the city kings fell in line. They offered their men again, promised results, and guaranteed their warriors were the very best. With luck, half of what they said would be true, and if half of what they promised held, Oren would have his 1,200.
Why the hurry?
Akakios asked before Oren could leave.
Don't you trust yourself to take Tiganian once he reaches his city?
Don't you want to hold your parliament and name a high king before the many senites it takes to complete a siege? Oren shot back, then bit his tongue. Devious as the man was, Akakios remained one of the closest things to a supporter Oren could count on. I can take the city, but the citizens will suffer. I see no point in it. I also see no point in giving Tiganian time to confer with his Svei cronies and call for reinforcements, or to choose the best locations to set up traps for us. If we catch up to them while en route, they won't have the terrain as an advantage, and we will only fight a fraction of his forces at a time.
But you won't be as ready either.
And it was genuine curiosity, Oren realized. Akakios wanted to understand his strategy. How to explain that his footing was surest when the world tumbled under his heels. How to make them understand that everything from his childhood to how he inherited the Westmerian throne had prepared him not just to survive the chaos of battle, but to thrive in it. That's why I demand trained soldiers. Oren gave up on explanations. Some truths remained too personal to be shared, their edges shaping him to a sharp point he wouldn't reveal to those who viewed him as an enemy. A trained soldier is ready to fight on command, and swift action won't hobble his abilities half as much as it will cripple our foes. And that was true as well, even if it was no answer. Akakios considered his reply as if he could see what Oren had revealed, and what he had hidden behind his words. After a moment that felt endless, he nodded.
You will have your soldiers, he said again.
The statement sounded different from his nonchalant offering of troops. Each word held weight, intention. When before he might have followed the plan, now he offered a promise.
"You'll be able to march at dawn."
Orin inclined his head a touch, an angle between the agreement of a general and the graciousness of a king. "I will be outside the southern gate waiting for an updated report," he said. "Let your men know we won't march at dawn. I expect to cover no less than 5 miles before sunset."
"Sunset?"
the eldest city king sputtered, choking on the drink he'd taken in open dismissal.
That's...
Throwing a symbolic glance at the sky, Orin allowed a shrug to ease his posture, a tiny smile clinging to the corners of his lips. "That's soon," he agreed. "And the more time you make me waste, the sooner it'll be." He said nothing else. He'd made his point, laid out his arguments. Now all he could do was fulfill his word, and prolonging an unpleasant exchange wouldn't bring him any closer to his goals. And besides, there was a petty pleasure in leaving the Myrdoni city king babbling, in controlling how a conversation ended when he stood so far from his home, his seat of power. He shouldn't be petty, but he was human, and he had to take small solace where he could find it. After all, the coming Senites would be grim and dark enough. Chapter 3 Interlude The Infirm. Darkness clung to the room. It often did, day or night, regardless of the season. Thick curtains covered the only window, and the stone walls were so thick, light always seemed to dance out of reach anyway. At one point, copper braziers lit the space, and lamps of white, stinking oil dimmed and brightened, following the pattern of the sun in the sky. No longer. The room's permanent inhabitant had nothing new to lay eyes on, and he found the glare of illumination pierced his skull like a hammer driving a nail on his coffin's lid. No, he preferred the darkness, the murk lulling his senses enough to let him pretend the pain had blurred. It also helped blur the passage of time, to the point that he could only guess how many days had passed between one silent opening of the well-oiled gate and the next. That was one such moment. The gate slid open, a rectangle of torchlight against the murk, and a figure blocked the light as they entered the room. Then,
"Damn you above and below, and damn this damnable table as well."
Noise, clattering, something hitting wood, hard. It sounded a lot like a knee.
"You left it there,"
Elmer said from his place, prostrate on the bed. And that was the other reason he liked the dark. It didn't hurt his eyes, and it provided one of his few sources of amusement when one of his old comrades came calling. They always came, every day without fault. Sometimes he thought their visits were more frequent than his nurse's.
"I didn't,"
Luke grumbled.
"It must have been the nurse."
"You asked for porridge the last time you visited," Elmer countered, "and you insisted on dragging the table closer to hold your bowl."
"Well, why isn't it back in its proper place?"
"Did you put it in its proper place?"
Luke made his way to a leather armchair that had seen better days and plopped down on it, his armour creaking against it as he leaned back.
"What sort of joke is that? I'm your Lord Captain, you know."
"Not mine."
That still hurt. Salt in an open wound that never cleansed its infection. After a lifetime of service, to think he no longer belonged in the Mountain Guard, no longer concerned himself with the comings and goings of regimented life, it was worse than the wound in his belly. And that bedamned wound refused to close, rotting him from the inside out.
"Yes, yours," Luke said, forcefully. "You're not dead, you're not discharged, you're still a guardsman, I'm afraid."
He wished he was. He really, really did. And moments like these, visits like these, reminded him of the lie while allowing him to live in it a bit longer. Then, as if Luke sensed the turn his mood threatened to take, he produced a piece of parchment.
"He seemed fit to write," he said.
He didn't specify who he was. No need.
"You know, I can't tell if you're angry because he's written, or angry because he hasn't written until now."
With a grunt, Elmer adjusted his position on the bed, enough to reach a blind oil lamp on the small stool that functioned as a bedside table. His fingers tapped the hood and, following the cue, thoughtless and automatic as breathing, Luke reached for the lamp through the dim. It took a moment of finagling, and then the lamp's hood opened, warm light revealing Luke's perpetual scowl as well as a shadow of a beard well past regulation.
Well?
Elmer prompted, blinking watering eyes that had grown too used to the dark.
What does he say?
Luke didn't read the letter. Instead, he went off on a list of curses and expletives that covered Elmer's entire repertoire, and then some. Indeed, the man had discovered some unique turns of phrase.
That bad,
Elmer cut in when his captain had to breathe. Because yes, damn it all, above and below, no matter what happened and how prostrate in bed he was. He remained a guardsman, and Luke had inherited the captain's mantle.
He's crossed over to Myrdin, Luke said at last. He's taken his queen all the way to Sharnet, doffed his crown, and hopped across the bedamned Sansford Range in the middle of winter.
Elmer laughed, and the effort sent a spear of agony through his gut. All mirth died with a hiss, and Luke forgot his anger to hold his shoulders steady, steady. Sometimes putting pressure on his wound helped. Sometimes it made things worse. Elmer decided not to gamble and held as still as he could while the bout of pain ran its course.
That boy hasn't lost the knack to surprises, has he?
He wheezed when he could once more control his breathing. That boy. Not a boy, not by a long shot. He was the king, and he was a man through and through. But age and a sickbed gave Elmer some privileges. That Luke didn't agree at once, though, told him the surprise didn't end with a daring raid across the border.
I imagine he found the pass the Myrdoni used last year before the Battle of the Red Pass, he said. Why did he cross?
Because unexpected or not, Oren's actions always followed a plan.
He had a notion to keep the Myrdoni from declaring war on us come spring, Luke said, nodding at the piece of parchment. Why that thought occurred to him or how he meant to make it happen, he didn't say.
What does he say?
Luke raised his gaze, met his, haunted eyes underneath the bluster. Genuine worry under the facade of anger. Luke's throat bobbed on a swallow, as if the words had stuck to the roof of his mouth.
He's killed the High King of Myrdin, he said.
What? Why?
And how? How did a single man amble up to the most powerful man of a kingdom and just kill him? Living long enough after the deed to write letters telling of it. But Luke had more to share.
He's their general now, Elmer, he said, forcing a laugh. Our king is their general.
That made no sense. Desperate schemes and near impossible plans Elmer could understand, but he must have made some noise of surprise, for Luke shrugged.
Temporary, he says, only while he defeats Tiganian and the Svei. Why Myrdin might have turned on Tiganian and what role Svetla might play in all of it, he doesn't say.
And there it was, the crux of the anger and frustration. Not enough information. A picture of the situation and no explanation of how it had passed.
He just said to be ready, in case he fails, you understand. He says he wants to cut them off in the Myrdoni plains before they get close to the Fremont Pass, and that he expects the enemy will break and give up on any idea to march on Burville, but we should be ready just in case.
Just in case. That hung ominously over their heads, encroaching as the too sweet stink of Elmer's rotting wound. Just in case Oren failed. Just in case the Myrdoni, who had somehow given him command, had decided otherwise, gifting him a knife between his ribs that would go unseen in the heat of battle.
What will you do?
Luke glanced at the crumpled letter. He didn't read it, but still he held it as if it had all the answers.
He says how many men he has under his command. Way too many, if you ask me. If they turn on him, he won't survive.
It didn't take many traitors to kill a man. A single one could do it. But there was an illusion of fairness when one could see a way to survive a fair fight, when one could plot a course to escape a dire situation. A single man, or five, or even a score of them. They could be outwitted, fought against, outraced. There was hope that one could learn of their treacherous intent in time to elude their trap. But what could a man do against 100? How could a man outpace 1,000 soldiers? One bout of combat, one dash of freedom, sure, but he'd be run down and killed before he even made it out of the camp.
If he had less, he wouldn't survive the battle ahead,
Elmer said. It needed saying, too, if Oren meant to take Tiganian in full, and if Tiganian had procured allies along the way, no desperate last stand would let him survive with less than 1,000 men at his back. Danger ahead, danger behind. So clear, Luke's anger. so easy to understand now.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?